I'm Ashley Eicher.
I'm Hunter Kelly.
And welcome to an all new episode of the All Our Favorite People podcast. This week we have our good friend Miles Adcox, and this episode was really special for both Hunter and I, because if you listened to our episode a couple weeks ago with Lauren Elena, you heard a little bit about OnSite. She and I were both there at the same time. It's a place that's about an hour outside of Nashville that offers workshops that are all about personal growth, kind of really digging in and facing your trauma and your wounds and getting the tools to be able to heal and live healthier.
Yeah, so Miles is the head of OnSite. He also pops up from time to time on Dr. Phil, and he has a great podcast with our friend Ruthie Lindsay called Unspoken, where they really dig in to a lot of these issues, but also just really talk about those things that are hard to talk about.
You know, and we had so many questions and people reaching out after the Lauren Elena episode where we talk about OnSite. We thought it would be really great to have Miles on and talk more about mental health and therapy and why we think the work is so important. We also share a lot about both of our experiences. I know you get really personal in this episode.
Yes. So I was listening back to this. We recorded this a few days ago, and I was listening back editing, and I was like, wow. Okay. So what is they call that? A vulnerability hangover?
Yeah, a vulnerability hangover okay. Is what Brene Brown calls
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Oh, Brene. Well, y'all should know Brene Brown is also factors into this conversation quite a bit. I don't think we even get to her last name. We just call her
Brene. We do at the end, towards the end.
Yeah, just one name, like Cher, Brene. But I really,
Oprah.
But I really did, you know, I shared a lot about things I don't know that I definitely haven't shared in this forum. It felt like being in therapy, but it was great. I mean, I'm really glad that I was able to ask these questions of Miles.
Yeah, this episode, it gets really deep, and I really think it's important because one of the things that you brought up to Miles at one point was how, like, even this news cycle and so many things that are being talked about, it can trigger really deep pain and wounds for people. And Miles has some really great insight into that. So as I was listening back, I know our hope in this episode is that it just is helpful. And if you've are struggling, or if you've thought about counseling or therapy, or you're looking for resources, Miles talks about those as well, from books to different groups that you can be a part of to therapy itself.
Yeah. So just go ahead and listen and hit us back if there's anything that resonates with you in this episode. It'd be great. And we'd love to help you get those resources as well.
Absolutely.
Here it is, Miles Adcox.
Miles, thank you so much for being here. We're here with our friend Miles Adcox, who is the owner and CEO of OnSite, which is a place that I went to in January that I call it the hardest and best thing that I've ever done and changed my life. And we were talking before we started recording. I keep calling OnSite therapy boot camp, but that's not really probably the best description. So can you tell, just for anyone listening at home that doesn't know, can you kind of explain it a little bit?
Yes. Thanks for having me, by the way. I'm excited to be here with both of you. And, you know, I don't have, honestly, a good, what do they call those things? Elevator pitch for OnSite, just because it translates different for a lot of people. And I think whatever frame feels comfortable to people, I think it's okay. But I would say we're an emotional health retreat center, and we're on 250 acres just west of Nashville. And so people come for a variety of different reasons, but we offer like 4-day to 7-day intensive workshops that just help you do a deep dive on anything that might be holding you back and be able to rewrite any parts of your narrative that aren't supporting you and becoming the best version of you. Now we've got some really smart people to pull that off. So it's a sophisticated kind of clinical model, but it's really, we've tried to humanize the idea of therapy and personal growth so that it's not this thing that is out there that you go to when you think you need it, but then you just realize everybody deserves it. And so,
I mean, let's talk a little bit just about background and history. You and I have been friends for a long time. I think we're on like 7 or 8 or 9 years now. I don't even remember. And we met through our good friend, Rondell Richardson. But I know that we've talked about OnSite so much over the years. You know, there have been several times you're like, I mean, Ash, you should just come on to OnSite. And I even went and toured it a couple of years ago. And there really is something about it just being time. Like when it's the right time for you to go. And I know for me, even though I'd been in counseling for, we're just going to dive into all this stuff, but I was going to talk about how great your hair is today.
Miles has great hair. I feel like I'm in a hair rut, so I do want to talk about your hair later, but go forth.
Oh, you want to go, we'll go into the deep and come back to your hair. Yeah. You know, for me, I think when I, the experience of going in January, I've been in counseling on and off for the last couple of years and dealing with some stuff that, you know, came out of a very toxic, destructive relationship, those lies of like shame and not enough, that I literally just became the lens through which I saw everything through, every decision, whether it was personal or professional, but didn't really realize it. Like, I thought that I'd found, you know, we'd gone through some family history stuff. I'd gotten to the root of some things in counseling, but for some reason, there were things that triggered in around Thanksgiving that I couldn't figure out why, you know, to the outside world, everything looked amazing. Like work is going great. Life is going great. But for some reason, I would just break down and cry all the time in December. And I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And I remember going to see my counselor and she and I talking, and I just remember being like, I mean, is it time for me to go to on-site? Almost terrified that she was going to say, I just figured she'd be like, no, I think you're fine. Cause like a year ago she said, oh, I think you're fine. We've done the deep work. She's like, you've done a lot of deep work. Like, I think you're okay. And then literally she goes, yeah, it's time. And then I called you. I think I saw you the night before. I was like, I think I'm calling you tomorrow, but I'm not sure yet. So let me talk to my counselor. But there was something she said. She goes, Ashley, we've hit the deep of the deep. Hmm. Like, we've hit the deep of the deep pain. And I think it's time. And so what I was saying to you earlier, where I feel like, and I've said this to other people, it was sort of divine the way everything worked out in order for me to be able to go in like a week and a half to go in January. But it really was, I remember in that very first counseling session in our group counseling at on-site, they're asking like what our fears were. And I remember saying to my counselor, I was like, I've done this work before. That I, again, we hadn't dug in, we hadn't really dove in yet in the group setting, but I was like, my biggest fear is I'll be in here all week and then nothing's going to change because I'd been in counseling for these things before. But the reality is by the end of it, I mean, it completely changed my life and I felt freedom from shame and those lies of not enough that I haven't felt in over a decade or longer. And so I think so much for me, it was just about it being the right time. Do you see that for a lot of other, that was a long dissertation to get to here, but do you see that with other people?
Yeah, I think it is different for everybody. You said something important in there when you said you knew everything, but yet your body was telling you something different, meaning you had all the tools, you'd done a lot of great work, but then suddenly you would find yourself crying. And the beauty about the foundation that you laid and the work that you did is without all that, you probably wouldn't have been awake to paying attention to what your body was telling you. And our bodies are so, and our minds are so, such a wealth of information, and they store so many gifts for us that are beneficial for the healing process when we have enough self-awareness to pay attention to it. Yeah. So everything you did up until then, and I say that it's different for everybody, you know, with yours is a more ideal path. I'll say that somebody who's done a lot of, well, you shared earlier, quite a bit of counseling. And so you built this beautiful foundation before you kind of ran a marathon. And, yeah. And I think it was like all the work that led up was conditioning. And then you came to on-site and you did this, you ran the marathon. And when you crossed the finish line, and in a sense, it's not like there won't be more marathons to run or more training to do. There will be, but crossing that for the first time for me, when I had my first really deep experience where other people saw me and I saw them, I was untethered from the hustle of culture, was on a digital detox. And so there was nowhere for me to go other than just to sit with mine and other people's pain. My experience is it's impossible for people to do that and not have their empathy go up. Yeah. And that's the beauty of that experience, is you walk out more empathetic towards yourself and towards other people. And you have this sense of, I think that raises our shame ceiling to where we've got a more space to breathe without being so hard on ourselves in the process. And we walk away thinking, I can do this. And one of the biggest takeaways from an intensive process like on-site is you kind of walk away, and hopefully it reframes because you're doing it with so many other people, that the idea of this is actually not that daunting. It's actually quite fun to be in the deep end. Now, I don't know. Every year I still do a tune-up. And I still have the natural response of like, oh no, here we go again. So I still have that. As much as I love it, I still have a natural resistance to the idea of going and really pulling back, taking a look.
And you're around it all the time, too.
That just tells you how real it is for people who are out there kind of, you know, where the phone feels like a 10,000 pound. Can I really pick it up? But to answer your question, it's different. It's really different for everybody. We know what we know about trauma is that trauma impacts the brain. Everybody's wired differently, and therefore trauma impacts people differently. Yeah. And the healing path looks a little different, similar, but a little different.
Well, there were so many things you said that now I'm trying to remember everything I wanted to say afterwards. So at some point, we'll get to it. Were you about to say something?
Oh, yeah. No, I've definitely felt that.
I need to gather my thoughts.
I have not been to on-site yet, but I'm definitely a good candidate because I've been, you know, off and on since 1992. In counseling and therapy, and also in recovery as well. I can tell that, though. It's like you have those emotional moments where you're like, okay, something's got to change. I'm in a moment here. So yeah, I've definitely had those.
Well, I think for me too, going into on-site, you talked about this, is that I remember the week before, despite the fact having a lot of friends that have gone over the years and heard about it and knew about it. And then obviously having you and other friends that work at on-site and hearing about it from you and having toured the facility, that for some reason that week before, I mean, it was like every nervous tendency came out. I was like, I mean, I had bitten my nails off and I'm like, I hadn't done that in like at least 20 years. I was like, what is going on? And so that even like you were saying, when you go in, it's like that anticipation of, I know I'm about to do a deep dive. But at the same time, one of the things that was really surprising to me that week is that you develop this camaraderie, like you said, with like other people that are with you, because there's something so beautiful, one, being cut off from the rest of the world for the week. And like you said, just standing in each other's pain together and seeing that when the walls are down and you're in a safe place. Mm-hmm. And especially what I love about the way on-site is set up is that, you know, like you guys take the phone and email. So I have no phone and no email all week. So I'm not even... It was amazing to me, as much as I feel like I'm married to this thing, how quickly it just, I didn't care anymore that I didn't have it. But it was also because you start to be in real community with people that we're all just there trying to show up and deal with some of our deepest hurt. And you also have no idea what no one does. No idea what no one does. All right, correct English today. You don't have any idea what anyone else does for a living, and you don't know anybody's last name. And so even in just that, the walls are down for all of us to just be. And there's no preconceived notions about anyone else. And what I watched happen, not only in my small group, but then also in the group of friends that I kind of made, that we would spend breakfast, lunch, and dinner together and then sit out by the fire every night and kind of just laugh and decompress. Like the beauty of standing together in each other's pain and working through those moments. Like it just, I didn't expect that. I don't know if I knew what to expect, but I think that was one of the really beautiful things I came away with, that when we just are really real and honest, there's really some deep healing and beautiful things that can happen. And that I'm just so grateful for coming out of it. And I think I feel when people really see you and you let yourself be seen like that in a safe place, and like these people know my crap at this point, but and that they still looked at me and said, you are loved and you are incredible and you are special. And, you know, and to be that loved and seen in the midst of people seeing the deepest, darkest places of your crap where you didn't think that was possible, that to me was really transformative.
Wow. That was beautifully said. I'm taking a deep breath, honestly, because I live in this space, but to hear it described in the way you did really brought it together for me. Honestly, it was a beautiful reflection of the work. Somebody, I was just recently in London and Scotland, I think it was last month, meeting with some people and learning about some of the cool stuff they're trying to do in Europe right now in the emotional wellness space, and was meeting with, you know, the really influential leader who is just really passionate about mental health. And he had heard about our work and he said, what's the secret? And, you know, I immediately thought, I was kind of nervous anyway, talking to him. And I thought, I need to show him how smart I am and say something really wise here. And then the nerves, thankfully directed me in a good way of just being, no, it's, you gotta be authentic to what you know is true. And I just said, really, honestly, if you take the humanity out of healing, then you miss the point. Hmm. And so really, if there's anything good about what we do, it is, yes, do we have sophisticated clinical tools and really smart people facilitating group processes? Yes. But we really try to see people as people, not as problems.
Yeah.
And make this a human experience, not a therapy experience. And because of that, you reflected much better than me. People hopefully walk away feeling seen, heard, and valued at their core, which is what the way connection is described. And if we can walk away feeling more connected, I think we treat each other more humane and treat ourselves more humane. And it just makes the world better. So.
Yeah. And I know I did the Living Centered program, but there are, just so kind of anyone's listening that, you know, isn't looking at a website or something like that, can you just sort of describe a couple different programs? Because I think, you know, when I was, I know the term sometimes therapy and counseling and group counseling, it's like there's a stigma and people are scared. And I think part of this for both of us, knowing that how important that aspect has been in our lives and how transformative it is to kind of help, you know, kill that stigma a little bit. Can you kind of just talk about a couple of the programs?
Yeah. So we've got, and I'm not exactly sure how many, I think there's maybe 7 to 10 workshops and intensives at Living Center programs. One you describe, it's kind of our, the one we're known for. It's our general program, but we've got a week long program called Healing Trauma Program. We've got Healthy Love and Intimacy. We've got Healthy Sexuality. And these are people who've had an unfortunate imprint early on to what that experience was like. And therefore, it kind of shaped the way we tried to move through life, trying to develop intimate relationships. And it's not that LCP doesn't cover all that. It's just the other ones go a little deeper in some of those directions. The long-term program, and those are all 4 to 7 days. And then we do some individual intensives, couples intensives, and family intensives as well. The longer-term program was honestly out of a need that I used to be in that space. I used to run a residential kind of rehab for addiction, eating disorders, and prior to getting into, you know, to on-site. And it wasn't that I necessarily missed the long-term, a bit more acute crisis type space. It's just I thought we were doing a disservice to that space because there were so many people that needed more than what a week could give them that were begging us to come to a week-long program because they knew they could be treated different than if they went somewhere and it felt more like a hospital type program. You know, one of our key values is that no matter what, from the moment you're picked up as, from a driver from the airport or the first phone call, we never add shame to anybody's story.
Yeah,
because that's such a big thing for you to speak up, speak out, and ask for support.
It takes so much courage just to pick up that phone and say, hey, something's not right and I need help. Like, that takes incredible courage.
And it doesn't take but like a quarter turn. And very, it's unintended usually, but if you move into advice of telling people what they need to do, that can feel like shame to people.
Yeah.
And so we really try to back up and just hear people. But there's so many people asking me about coming. And so we created it out of demand about 5 years ago. Just to, it's small. It's a 20-bed program. And our specialty is trauma, depression, anxiety. We don't specialize in addiction. We do work with addiction, but it's after somebody's had kind of primary. So they've gone to like some other program, Cumberland Heights or Betty Ford, and they've got kind of the basic addiction information, then we would kind of help them untether the narrative that might be driving the addiction. So there are people there that come, but usually not as a first stop. But a lot of people come to that if they're trauma survivors or anxiety, depression, and things like that.
Got it. Okay. Cleared some things up for me today, Miles.
Yeah. Me too, actually.
And today I was like, oh, okay.
I have that deer in the headlight looks a lot when somebody says, so what do you do? I'm like, I'm not sure.
How do I describe that?
And you're also, you know, so we have something in common with you also having a podcast, the Unspoken Podcast with Ruthie Lindsay. So I've known you, I guess, the same amount of time. I would have met you through you know, the JODA organization.
Yeah, Winona.
Winona. And which one Ashley of
the,
actually, was
that might be the connect. Well, Ron, our friend Rondell, but then that might also be part of it too, was Winona, because I had worked for her and then you became great friends with the Judds. And
So I see that.
Hunter loves the Judds and has a great relationship with them as well.
Devoted to my life to them.
But thank you, Judds, for bringing us all together.
Thank you. You remember the, there used to be a live, I don't know if you call it honky tonk because it's not on Lower Broad, but it was live music at Vanderbilt. Is a hotel there?
Was it the Commodore Inn?
Yes.
We were there watching Cactus play
with Y.
Yeah,
I remember.
That was the night she gave me a can of hairspray. Why known as hairspray? I mean, that's a Can you imagine, like, in 20 years? This is one known as hairspray.
I mean, what a get. What kind of hairspray was it?
It was Elnett.
Was it White Rain?
It was L'Oreal Elnett. Get Bite in Bulk on Amazon. They used to.
Is it a stronghold?
This is 10 years ago, so I don't know. I've not seen Winona do her hair in a minute. But I know there's glitter involved. No, but and also know Ruthie. So I've known Ruthie at least since 2003. So to hear the two of you together on this Unspoken podcast has really been fascinating for me, because I've known the two of you separately, and now to hear your stories kind of come out. But I was curious, because you kind of mentioned being from a small town, Miles. So what small town was that?
It's a little town called Hohenwald, Tennessee.
Oh, y'all get a lot of tornadoes.
Yeah, I don't know that we get any more than normal Tennessee.
I guess maybe because when the weather person says Hohenwald, you know, it really stands out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not to be confused with hole in the wall. Everybody thinks that's what it sounds like, which there is a hole in the wall, Montana.
Okay.
But not, Hohenwald is actually German. It's Hohenwald. It's German for high forest. So we have a Swiss German heritage. It's a beautiful little town. It's a town of 5,000. And my mom and dad still live there on the farm I was raised on. My siblings, I have two, they live in Columbia now. My brother pastors a church down there. And so, yeah, we're all grew up and live in that little area. And it's just a lot of my... there were a lot of beautiful advantages to growing up in a small town. And of course there were some challenges as there would be anywhere. But for the most part, I have nothing but really fond memories of growing up there.
So how did you go from Hohenwald to the job you're in now and your position? Because, you know, it's a journey from point A to point B. There's a story there.
There's a story there for sure. And one in which we probably wouldn't have time for me to tell the whole thing, but I guess an abbreviated version was something that was really important to me growing up in a small town, especially in the South, is athletics, sports were a big deal. You know, it's Friday Night Lights, that was a real thing in Tennessee, Texas, and all these small Southern towns. And it was where, for me, I learned to get validation around my worth and who I was. I was natural as an athlete, and so I picked it up, and I just played everything. And football, baseball, basketball were the main three that the school I went to. And coaches became kind of mentors for me in a lot of ways. And there's still Coach Pace, Coach Sharp. There's a lot of coaches that I can look back at pivotal points in my life, I think, that kind of pulled me back on path. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I had some crash and burns following just after undergrad and grad, which I'll share, as that led me into what I do now. Mm-hmm. But when I look back at pivotal moments in my life, one, it kept me out of trouble because I was always on a field doing something year round, and I was prone to trouble. I was kind of the black sheep in my family. And so I got in enough of it, but it kept me out of a lot of it. So I think it saved me in a sense. But I didn't have any outlets or didn't explore any outlets to experience the rest of me. It was kind of like sports gets you a lot of attention, especially if you're good at it. So go do it, because it'll make you popular and that'll make you feel good and da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And it did. But yet there's a whole nother part of me that's artistic in nature, that loves music and art. And I just never got to express that, because I thought as a man's man growing up in the South, that definitely wasn't cool.
Right.
And you shouldn't let people know or talk about that. I secretly loved music and the music wasn't so much, but just film, music, chick flicks, enormous Oprah fan. So that was my imprint. And so I felt like I moved into my undergraduate experience thinking I only know how to do one thing, and that's sports. And so that's where I put my attention, is I thought, well, I'm just going to do that professionally. I thought I'll become whatever you can be as a sports job. I thought maybe broadcasting, maybe an agent, you know, I didn't know, but, so I kind of just kept that focus. There was this little part of me inside that was screaming to be seen that I didn't even know was in there. And it ended up being a little bit of a conflict. There was part of me that was going away that I felt like the outside world wanted to see me go. And there was another part of me that wanted to be seen as my authentic self, and they were clashing. And so that I started to, for the first time, I didn't have a word for it back then, but I started experiencing depression, anxiety, kind of what you experience when you don't really get to be you. I started having some of those thoughts and feelings, and thankfully I was able to kind of manage. Well, I say thankfully, I don't know if it helped me or not. It would have been nice to get that education I got earlier, but I didn't. But I managed those until I got out of grad school, and then I got it, landed my dream job in the sports industry. Worked for a big sport marketing agency that represented collegiate properties and way outkicked my coverage in terms of my skill set. I couldn't believe I got the job that I got. But I was so excited. Everybody was so proud. Family was so proud. And then when I started, which required a lot of, you know, we were doing TV, radio, print things around sports. It required a lot of entertaining people, which required a lot of late nights. And just,
yep.
And I just, I could put on my extrovert, but truly I'm more, a little bit more of an introvert, or I'm kind of an ambivert or whatever that word is when you're both.
Yeah.
But I was pretty miserable trying to be somebody I wasn't. And I kept that gig up. Thankfully, I kind of ran out of runway with that in my early 20s. And what caught up with me is I was kind of medicating. What depression kind of grew as compound emotion does. Mm-hmm. And then I medicated it, numbed it out in a lot of unhealthy ways. Mm-hmm. It was fun, and then it wasn't fun anymore. And I remember the loneliness of the social circle felt so big and in every direction, but I didn't feel known by anybody. And so I kind of had a bit of a crash at the peak of what felt like professionally looked like the best on paper you could ever see. And yet personally, I was kind of dying on the inside. Well, that led me into counseling and therapy. And it's a long story, long, funny story about how the challenges, which helped imprint me to what I'm part of creating today, but had some bad experiences and some good experiences. But the good experiences ultimately led to the right people coming around me at the right time. And I had a lights coming on moment. And that was when I started my love of the helping profession. Now, I think as a little boy, I always had it because we grew up on a farm. I had a pack of strays following me around as a boy everywhere I went. I just always loved the underdog in each of us, which we all have one. And I've always been empathetic towards it before I knew I was supposed to be in the helping profession. But it was through the lens of my own experience that got me on the path I am today.
There's so many things that you said that made me, that was making me think about just those narratives that we start to believe that even when they, you know, happen, like where you talk about playing football and how that became a part of your identity. For me, it was performing and being on stage and singing and, you know, you start to hear, and this is some of the things we kind of pulled out even deeper when I was at Onsite, but you start to hear all these narratives of like, well, if I'm not performing, if I'm not perfect all the time, then I'm not lovable or I'm not accepted. And so, which is completely not true, but it's even the most innocent thing at the time, as far as like probably a compliment. I look back and I'm like, I realized that's where I started to crave the spotlight. And that defined the way I felt about myself. And that then, you know, unchecked has led to like all of these other things that eventually at one point took a destructive turn. And you talked about medicators. And one of the things that was really surprising to me in this work is like the different medicators. Like automatically, I think I've always probably thought, oh, it's like alcohol or drugs or sex or whatever, all the ones you've heard. But then when we were in the work, they're like, oh, you know, social media addiction, there's like phone addiction, like there's other things you can use to medicate as opposed to just those big three I've always heard about my entire life.
Yeah. And people often, everybody typically has a go-to medicator.
Yeah.
Some people
approval.
Have different relationship. Approval is a big one. Work is a big one. Technology is a huge one right now that we don't even know all the implications around. But I'm glad you said that because I think for so many of us, that's when it's so easy for us to pick up a microscope when we see the extreme version, when we see somebody who's an alcoholic or struggling with addiction or anorexia or bulimia. It's almost like we sympathize with that, but they feel very separate from our life experience, meaning the rest of culture, although that's a pretty serious thing that a lot of people can relate to. But the truth is, if you put the microscope down, kind of pick up the mirror, you're a quarter turn away from your own medicator. It just looks and feels different, but the implications are typically the same, just a little slower.
Oh, the medicators. Now, they do go through like a checklist. I was like, do I have all the medicators? Like, what? And you're like, oh, I need more help than I think. But it's fascinating though, too, because you don't realize. And then coming out of the experience at Onsite, I think one of the things that you guys say, like, it's a process when you come out, like, you realize that you've got the tools now to make better decisions. So that's really, and I'm only 2 months out now, and I'm like, I feel like I'm doing pretty good. But you realize that like every decision you're kind of making, you're actually taking a step back to kind of think about like, okay, wait, what is this? Like, why am I reacting out of what I'm reacting out of as you're trying to put like healthier things in place in your life over time?
Well, hopefully it just changes the conversation.
Yeah.
Evidence to support that the three of us are here talking about it. I mean, yeah. That just, 10 years ago, this wouldn't happen. I mean, you two are really well-respected in the entertainment space as reporters. I know you've done a lot of cool things in that space, and yet you're making time to have a deep conversation around this topic on this platform. That's huge. I mean, we're normalizing that conversation, and hopefully one day we can walk into our school, in our work, or in our church, and feel what you felt at OnSite. That curated experience where everybody's safe to be seen.
Yeah.
The good parts, the broken parts, all the parts, and that we can hold each other up in that way.
Well, because what I think you realize is that everyone's got some sort of brokenness, and everybody has trauma. You just don't know it or you don't see it, but it's really easy, especially the way social media is now, is that for us to get on social media and look at like, oh, your life looks perfect and your life looks perfect. And I think that's, again, been the surprising thing to me is like the number of people that have kind of come out of the woodwork wanting to talk about. And I'm sure you see this too, being with what you do and people confide in you a lot, that you realize just there's a lot of people hurting and everybody wants to be seen and known and loved at their deepest core, despite whatever's gone on in their life or the trauma that they've endured, whether they even realize it's trauma or not.
Yeah. None of us are issues. We're just all human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All worthy of love and belonging, every single one of us.
Part of your story that really resonated with me was I got my dream job working for a national news company at like 24. My story is I was kind of the golden child and had all this put on me, this responsibility to balance out my brother, who was the black sheep, you know, off the rails one. And so I got this job and started going out to be social like I had to be. The open bar was just where I went, you know, and it was really, over the course of about a decade, got really out of control. So thankfully, I did have a good friend who was able to come and talk to me. And then I actually called our friend Rondell and was like, hey, Rondell. And he put me in touch with Music Cares and then just got it figured out and then started a recovery program. But I got to tell you, like actually doing the work every week of like working our program, going to the meetings and also working with other people on it, to put that much time into my mental health and my program, it seemed really like overindulgent, I think, to me, like my old mindset. Like I was kind of like, okay, Hunter, you've had like years of therapy. You need to kind of just, you know what to do and whatever. There was stuff coming up and I was just numbing out and, you know. So I got to say, oh my God, like having that permission to like work on myself that much and be able to go and be in touch with myself and what's going on emotionally, whether it's through like, you know, journaling as well is a big outlet for me. I got to tell you, just giving myself that permission has been amazing.
Mm. I love that you said the giving yourself permission, because I feel like so often in the world we live in that people almost are like, well, it's selfish of you to take this time for yourself or self, like those lies. Mm-hmm. When really like you taking the time to dig in where you need to dig in and being emotionally as healthy as you can and trying to figure out those patterns that aren't healthy. Like, I think what I've seen, because I believed those lies for so long, like, oh, me taking this time, just like, you're fine. You'll figure it out. You're fine. Mm-hmm. When in really in getting to the root and actually facing things that are hard to face and trying to heal from them and praying and journaling and having the wise counsel around me of a great counselor, and then having, shout out to Mary at OnSite, like my counselor.
Mary B.
Oh,
she's a boss.
Mary B, if you're listening, I love you. The best. But having really gifted people around you, that's the thing of like giving yourself permission to say, like, in order for you to take care of everybody else, you got to first take care of you. Mm. And I think for me, and wanting to have healthier relationships and make better decisions, I just kind of came to a place where I'm like, I just have to do this. And I feel like that's for you too. You kind of said, like, this is what I got to do.
Well, I was also going to lose a job. I mean, that'll really light a fire under your butt.
Yeah, well, no. You said two things, which I appreciate you sharing that. There was some, we hadn't caught up in a while.
Yeah.
So there was some stuff in there I didn't know. And I've always appreciated in you and who I know you to be, but just knowing you at a deeper level now, honestly, yeah. I leaned in a little bit. I was like, wow, there's more connective, you know, relatable points. But you said two things. You said indulgence and permission. I think those are important because a lot of people have a little shame around self-care or thinking we need to do work around it. And to be honest, I've traveled to other countries, third world countries specifically, and some people have said depression, anxiety, addiction is kind of a problem of the affluent. And I've seen that not to be true because it's in every culture. Mm-hmm. I do think it's more prevalent here. But the reality is our culture conditions us in that way. And if we're going to live here, there's so many beautiful things about living here. And there's also some shadow stuff. And if we're going to do that dance, we've got to be congruent. In other words, if we were in other countries where we were surviving in a different way, then we probably wouldn't work as much on our self-care because we're working from a different part of the brain. But we happen to be here, and that's our current reality. So it's vitally important. And Brené says she's got this cool exercise using permission slips, where just like we did in school, where you got a permission slip for your teacher, where you write yourself permission slips on what you have. You feel you can do. So the fact that you intuitively went there is so important because that's a big block for most people when it comes to embracing doing their own work is they just don't feel like they deserve it.
Yeah.
And often that's all we need is permission.
Yeah. And I think it's also a little bit of the thing of like, I've got to go do this again, or I've got to deal with more stuff, you know, because I did use alcohol to like run away and just numb out. But the problem is it doesn't work. And then it just would bring up all of my, all of the stuff I was trying to bury would just come out in 2 a.m. text messages to coworkers or friends, you know, and it was like the big mess you have to clean up the next morning. And I'm just so grateful not to be living in that, you know.
I know there were some specific things that you were talking about before that I feel like would be really relevant to people listening at home.
Oh, God.
We talked about you wanted to kind of...
Yeah. So, well, another part of my story that I guess I'm starting to share more openly about is that I was molested when I was 3 years old. And that's really my first memory. And so I was able to, thanks to a song by Amy Grant called Ask Me, came out in 91. I was able to kind of really start to identify what had happened to me and told my parents and got help, you know, in fifth and sixth grade. And then I've also dealt with it as an adult in therapy. But it seems like lately there have been these situations. Over this last summer, it was like Christine Blasey Ford giving her testimony about Kavanaugh. And I just recognized something in her testimony about how, like, speaking about that sexual trauma and how, you know, I just identified with it as like, that is how I see myself when I'm talking about it. It's kind of hesitant. It's not overly emotional. And then, watching Leaving Neverland, the Michael Jackson documentary with the two boys who were talking about what they say Michael had, you know, had abused them. And I just also identified with them so much. So there's also this thing though, Miles, where it's like, and having been through this situation a few times as a survivor, I'm identifying with those people and I'm feeling like what seems like such a holy like moment of just like, I hear you, I understand you. And then I go online and I see people that I know calling these people liars, saying they're just doing, you know, and just attacking them. And it's hard not to feel that personally because I've had that connection with them. So I know that like I've been dealing with this with my therapist, but I know that you probably are seeing this kind of like, what do you do when you feel like your situation is being attacked? You know, that's it's
triggering something.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it'll throw you off. I mean, it throws me off.
Yeah. What is the, if I may ask, the primary emotion that you feel when you read those comments?
When I read those comments, like with the Christine Blasey Ford thing, it was a lot of people from back home in Alabama. And it made me really start to feel unsafe for the child that lived there and went through that. That I wouldn't be believed, and also really just really frustrated and angry that these people aren't able to apply this situation to their loved ones and put themselves in that situation. It's hard for me to, I guess, see the other side as well.
Well, I'm glad you shared that because I think unsafe is a pretty common response for, and we're seeing it a lot right now, not just with abuse survivors, but just everybody who spends time consuming media, because there is a vicarious and secondary component to trauma that by seeing it, experience it, and watching it all day, and then seeing the conflict that surrounds it, it can that can be traumatizing in itself. Mm-hmm. So in other words, secondary vicarious trauma is when you spend time hearing about other people's painful circumstances and it actually can take it on and feel mm-hmm. like yours. That's a common thing in the helping profession for people who are therapists and other mm-hmm. people. But now the media is such a 24-hour cycle that we all experience it. In your case, and thanks for the courage to share that, I can relate to it, and there's so many people I know that can relate to it. But for anybody, those of us that have experienced a certain kind of abuse, especially mm-hmm. sexual trauma in nature, then we're going to be a little more sensitive mm-hmm. To when we see or experience that. Because in a sense, it can take us back to either the moment it happened or the response we got when we spoke up about it. Mm-hmm. And that second part's important. It sounds like you, and I don't want to assume that, but it sounds like your response or the people you went to, your parents actually yeah. showed up in support. So yeah. that's a bonus. That doesn't always happen. And often the first person we choose to tell, their response can be as traumatic as the abuse itself if we're not embraced, heard. And so I think as abuse survivors, we're sensitive to it. So we feel we know the courage it takes to speak up. Mm-hmm. And when we see anybody add trauma on top of trauma, mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. it brings up an appropriate emotion, which would mm-hmm. be fear, mm-hmm. anger, sadness. Mm-hmm. Some of it's personal, some of it's just in a protect. That's why you see so many of our best advocates out there for a variety of different issues where people who've experienced pain and emotion themselves, mm-hmm. they got to a point where they felt like suppressed voices needed to be lifted up and they used their pain for good. Mm-hmm. But you're speaking about something that I get asked about all the time now. Like, how do I handle this ongoing consumption of media when I'm feeling triggered all the time? Mm-hmm. Two indicators. One could be that the fact that your body is awake and experiencing certain emotions mm-hmm. is a sign that you've done really good work. Mm-hmm. And another indicator could be if it were to get worse, like if it were it makes me feel really unsafe and sad to mm-hmm. where it starts giving you other symptoms, like mm-hmm. it's actually affecting my sleep or it's causing mm-hmm. anxiety and it's kind of getting big, then it might be a sign of maybe deeper work around that particular yeah. thing. So it could be both, but it's ultimately a sign that you're awake and alive yeah. to it.
I got to tell you though, and that's something that, you know, worked at a major news organization all through my 20s. And gosh, the older I get, it's just like I realize what a constant state of tension I was living in because I was tied to the email of the inner workings of the news organization. So it was just like constantly on high alert. So I'm just grateful not to be there right now. I may be back at some point, but it's nice.
Well, that it's the trauma gets stored in our limbic, and that's where those memories are. And we have to move them kind of from our right to our left brain, which is what happens in a lot of therapeutic practices. And sometimes we just have to revisit that mm-hmm. over and over again because it will get reactivated. That's why I'm always cautious of, and when I say, oh, I've done that, or mm-hmm. I've done that piece of work, or I've dealt with that, mm-hmm. That's usually a little internal flag. And I say it when I'm getting close to something, I've been like, oh, check that off the list. I've done that inner child stuff. But usually there's a good invitation to be like, whoever said it had to be done, you know, yeah. we can always go back and pull that little guy out if he needs mm-hmm. it, you know?
Yeah.
And you mentioned that inner child, and that was one of the things at OnSite that I remember, because you dig into the inner child there. And while I've done a little bit of that, there for some reason, the way it just hit them. But when you said that what triggered in you was that little boy inside back in Alabama that was so scared that someone mm-hmm. wouldn't believe you. Mm-hmm. And I just think about the people out there that might feel the same way. Yeah. And kind of like Miles was just saying, just the courage it takes to say everything that you just said.
Yeah. And that's another thing that I wanted to kind of talk about, Miles, is so that I feel like part of this is, I think it would help people to understand kind of what it looks like when somebody's talking about their trauma in a public space, the things to look for, because I think that I identify it because I've been there, but I think a lot of other people think like, you're too calm talking about this traumatic thing right now.
Like well, it must not have been that bad.
Like, why aren't you really upset talking about this in front of the world? So what is your insight on that? Like what it looks like?
Well, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, I think it's different for everybody. Mm-hmm. There's so much we know and so much we don't know about trauma mm-hmm. and how it impacts the brain. The good news is that it is very much a part of today's narrative. And mm-hmm. 15 years ago, that wasn't the case in mental health. And I used to be more in the addiction space mm-hmm. than the space I'm in now. And then people weren't even talking about trauma when I first mm-hmm. got into it. And now everybody is starting to recognize that there is typically a narrative that is underneath anything that we would use to compound or numb unhealthy behavior, whether it's addiction, other types of mental health. A lot of times trauma is what's underneath it. So we're talking about it, but I would say that we are where, maybe a little further than that, but kind of where computer science was in the 80s. When okay. you remember how fast mm-hmm. and everything, that's when the tech just took off, just mm-hmm. what, shortly after that. But that's where I think we're there with trauma. It's an exciting time because we're learning a lot about the science of it, but there's still so much we don't know. But one thing we do know is that everybody seems to respond a little differently to it. There okay. are some commonalities and themes, but you could take two soldiers, for example, that experience combat, and one could come back and develop post-traumatic stress syndrome symptoms, mm-hmm. and the other one could be well adapted and go back into life. A lot of times, more often than not, it has to do with their early attachment. So if there was any early adversity, then you can predict that if you experience it later in life, that you're going to develop some of those symptoms faster. And I guess to make that a little more clear, when we do some vets work, and when we work with combat veterans, we often never touch the combat stress. Mm-hmm. We go back into childhood, and it's usually sexual abuse mm-hmm. or something else that we're dealing with that we can't really work on this trauma until we go back to the original wound. Mm-hmm. But when you see people talk about it, do the best you can to stay in an empathetic position to the courage it takes for somebody to speak their truth. Mm-hmm. If they have a flat affect, if they're wildly emotional, if they're anything in between, just know that that's their journey. And we mm-hmm. have no idea what part of the process they're in. If it's the first time they've talked about it mm-hmm. or the 100th time they've talked about it, they deserve whatever emotion comes with it because they've busted their ass to come through it mm-hmm. to this place, whether they've done any work or not. I've seen it just looks different. Now, if we took three cases of media stories where somebody was revealing their truth on TV, could we overanalyze all their responses? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I just more or less want to say that it's different for everybody, and everybody deserves a space to be held and respected when mm-hmm. they're speaking their truth.
I have really loved seeing, I think, just the opportunities I think you've had to talk about mental health, especially in a variety of places and traveling over the world, but like including like the Dr. Phil show. I know you've been on there several times. And then obviously with the Unspoken podcast, is there anything that's kind of surprising you right now that you're seeing in terms of the work that you're doing?
It's actually a good question. And the answer is an easy yes.
Yeah.
It's, I love just the art of communication and connection.
Yeah.
Words really matter to me, how things get framed and talked about. And when I got into this space, I felt really abnormal as this fairly privileged guy that grew up and had what I had. And then suddenly I found myself in need of these services, which it felt like they were being communicated all wrong, or I should say branded all wrong. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I thought therapy unfortunately is branded as here's where you go and what's wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And it actually is what's right with you, that mm-hmm. you would go take a deeper look of your narrative and work out how to become a better version of yourself. And that's something anybody could get. We just never communicated it in that way. So early on I thought, oh my gosh, I'm new to this space and our messaging is horrible. And in a sense, we're creating some of the stigma that we complain about.
It's no wonder everybody's scared of it.
We box in our information around the premise of anonymity, but I think we're just too constricted in sharing our own stories. And I used to be like that. I used to be like, you know, because I'd love to move what I'm doing in 10 years from now. I love what I'm doing now. In 10 years from now, I might be in more of an advocacy or political space where I can make a larger impact. And I'm thinking now, what are the implications of me sitting here telling you guys I dealt with depression and anxiety? Will that hurt mm-hmm. me later on? I don't think so. I think if anything, it's the culture is going to start seeing that as our biggest strength, mm-hmm. not our biggest weakness, the fact that we can talk about all parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So the biggest surprise is the trend that it's now cool to talk about I say cool. It's acceptable and in cool in some circles to be authentic and vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that is something I never thought I'd see. I thought early on, I thought the advertising industry is using psychology information way better than we are because they know how to take what we know that affects human behavior and get people to change on a dime and make
those impulse decisions.
Right. And why don't we take a page from their playbook and try to get smarter about selling what we know is a good way of life, being more self-aware, having more emotional wellness. I just always thought I'd be pushing that snowball uphill because I thought I felt like alone, but there were pioneers before me that were talking about it. But now it's suddenly there's so many seats at so many tables that I'm being invited to that surprised the heck out of me. I'm like, really? You want me to come there and tell you about what I do? And so I think it's a beautiful time to be a part of the helping profession.
It's so interesting you say that just about thinking for a split second, like is in me sharing these things that are deeply personal, like is that going to affect me later on? And I remember coming out of OnSite and when I, a couple weeks later, felt like, okay, where I finally posted about it on social media. And for me, it was, this has been such an impactful experience in my life. And this is kind of just the start of another chapter in terms of healing and then living fully. You said that when I first was thinking about that post and as I posted it out of a place of wanting to just say to people, look, it's okay. Mm. If you need help, it's okay. Mm. And I'm not going to deep dive into where I've been because I don't think that that's appropriate in this space right now. But I will say this is stuff that I've struggled with on a high level, and this is the place that has helped me. And if you need help, it's okay to reach out. And I mean, I didn't, you know, who knows if anybody's going to care, but for me, it was from a place of like, I don't feel like I can start posting about like, oh, I'm at this event and I'm at this thing and this is great. And this is great for the rest of the year because this is the real stuff that's been happening in my life. And again, like I said, giving other people permission to say it's okay to ask for help. But I did have that split second thing. Probably a couple days after, it's like you see the way different people respond to what you're saying. And there's some people that are like, thank you so much for sharing this. I've thought about this, or thank you so much for sharing. And then you have other people that are like, gosh, I'm just so glad you got the help you need, but almost in a like bless your heart sort of way.
Yep.
And there in this split second trigger in me was, oh my gosh, what if like I have clients that I work with at big corporations or brands I work with, or other people I work with in the music industry that are just like, oh God, something's wrong with her. Like, is she okay? Can we work with her? Like, ooh, totally. Like what's going on? And then I was able to step back and be like, no, this has helped me to be a healthier, better version of myself, which is only going to make me better in all facets of my life. And so that kind of dissipated at some point, but I do think that is, that's a very real thing. That's a very real thing.
It is. And I'm glad you gave it voice because I've got the fortune of having an inside track to what I get to experience.
Yeah.
But I'm very much a student of our work, no different than anybody else. I don't have it perfected. And sometimes it gives me an advantage to be armed with all the tools, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I can be so close to them, I don't know how to implement them. Mm-hmm. And I can help 90 people with a certain issue, but I go home and my wife looks at me like, who are you? You know, some of the challenges, so I'm human, I very much struggle, but I get to see people at the top of their profession that, and fortunately they trust us to come, and regardless, it's politics, entertainment, you couldn't accomplish anything more than they have professionally. And yet
doctors, surgeon, like I've saw all kinds of.
Human is
yeah,
we are.
Human.
What's helping our case a little bit is there are a lot of influential people speaking out about it. And what I see, and I think what really smart people see, is there's integration. And integration is a huge bonus for a person to, you know, to learn more about them. But we're seeing gross abuses of it in top positions in culture right now, to where there's no humility. You can clearly see they're an untethered kind of hot mess.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's no humility to talk about any of it. So that's the extreme other version of it. And it's on pretty big display right now.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really, really
Amen.
Is.
Amen. Yeah. That's why I've enjoyed the block feature of Twitter this year. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know what people long for, I think, is for people in those positions. I think about, I would love to see a presidential debate where somebody said, I don't know.
I've never seen that.
And we know they don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And we know you study, you get briefed on foreign policy and all these things, but there's no way everybody's an expert on all of that. But they all have to pretend to sell us something. And I just thought, I've never trusted it. And so I look for the sliver of like, who's got enough humility to be like, you know what? I've got somebody way smarter than me. And I actually don't even know the answer to that.
Yeah.
God, I would look forward to that day one day, please. I have one last thing that I was thinking about, but do you have anything else you want to, or Miles, do you have anything you want to cover?
Well, yeah, I want to talk about Miles's hair.
Oh, yeah. Okay, before we get to Miles's hair, Miles, are there any, I mentioned like Brene Brown and Daring Greatly and Rising Strong and Braving the Wilderness. I can give, I'll just go ahead and get the
entire
pitch.
Bibliography of Brene Brown.
I'm give a pitch for every Brene Brown book.
Just get
because,
the box set.
Honestly, like, I underline, and then, and honestly, when I got back into counseling 2.5 years ago, I had already read Daring Greatly, and I went into first session with my new counselor, and she was like, hey, I want you to read this book, Daring Greatly, and I was like, oh, I've read it, totally fine, and then she's like, okay, I want you to read it while you're in here with me, and let's talk about it when you come in. Apparently, I didn't think I'd dealt with all those issues, and I ended up spending like 2 months with her in the chapter on shame. Which now looking back is not surprising, but it really, like I said, was the first introduction for me and having a resource to understand what I was feeling. Are there other resources right now that, I mean, even if people are kind of listening, they're like, well, I don't know. I'm nervous about therapy. I'm nervous about on-site or whatever it is, you know, obviously reaching out, there are resources there, but can you just talk about some different resources for people?
Yeah, there are a million books in there's some treasures too in the self-help space that people that didn't take off and weren't embraced by pop culture. And Brene deserves every bit of the accolades we're giving her because she's the real deal. The person behind what you read is an integrated, it's the same. And you don't often see that. I can attest to that. She can really back up what she's saying. And she's been a big part of why this is culturally trending.
Yeah.
If she spoke it in the information, although the research was new, a lot of the information wasn't necessarily new, but the way she framed it was quite brilliant. And finally, it was digestible. And the timing, I think, was right. But it was really the way she's just such a brilliant storyteller. And she got it out there. So I'd probably just back that up and say, start with
her. And she's hilarious.
Hilarious. But I will say a lot of people get discouraged because they'll hear us talk about like an on-site experience and then they'll look and realize I can't afford that.
Right.
And we do, I think anybody in the helping space should have a social impact tail if possible. Not everybody can do that when they're starting. I couldn't in the beginning, but now we do have a foundation that helps diversify our socioeconomic reach.
Yeah.
It's not as balanced as I would like it to be, but we've recently brought on really respected leaders like Lindsay Nobles, who had done some great things in the nonprofit space, and others who are helping us try to figure out how we balance that, how we even reach more people who can't afford it. So if you don't get too discouraged, if you see our programs, be like, there's no way, you can always look at, you know, call our foundation and see if they could help you with scholarships. Mm-hmm. They go fast. And so there, you could be disappointed too, because we have to say no more than we say yes, unfortunately, which I hate. But there are other resources that are free in nature that are better with insurance. And SAMHSA is kind of a website that has resources in every area of all socioeconomic backgrounds that anybody. I pretty much believe that anybody can get help. It's accessible. It's just going to be a little harder, unfortunately, without the resources, as with anything, but especially mental health. I wish it wasn't that way, but it is.
And maybe even hopefully just like we're saying, like a book or something that could at least help you maybe identify something.
Well, and I've been answering it this way because I think because we frame it in such a way that I hope everybody wants it. In other words, I hope everybody wants to improve their emotional health. Not everybody can have access to it, can take the time. It could be young parents. It could be people that can't take off work. It doesn't have to be reserved for the therapy room. Mm-hmm. You can have this in your community. So try to build authentic, safe community that can help you process and hear your story. There are free 12 steps. 12 steps is one of my favorite recovery oriented support groups because they have these principles that keep it safe. And those are free to anybody. And it doesn't just, and there's open meetings that you don't have to be an alcoholic to go to an AA meeting. There are closed meetings too. But there are also EA, Emotions Anonymous. There's CODA for codependent. So there's a lot of community-based grassroots resources that you can take advantage of that you don't have to go see often a therapist to work everything out.
Yeah.
Love me some 12-step, y'all. Okay, so let's get shallow. We've been deep. Let's talk about Miles's hair. So Miles, you've always had great hair, but it's really long now. You're a father, about to be a father twice, of two.
Another one on the way.
You got a little girl on the way, right?
Little girl.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I saw the photo of your Maverick kissing your wife's belly and almost died.
It was precious. Did you cry? You had a little tear?
Well, I felt emotional. There were no tears. So as a result, your hair is longer.
It is longer. It's always
longer as it's ever been.
You know, it started out as a kind of a lazy dad card where I just stopped going to get it cut. And, but then once I got, it's kind of for a minute there, I went through a phase where it was lower maintenance. Mm-hmm. Just you get out, you don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
But then I had realized I have no idea what to do with long hair. So I was, when I had a little shorter hair, I would use this product that is like a, not a gel, what do you call it? Like a pomade type thing. And if you put that on long hair, it just goes straight up. And so I literally look like a clown for 2 weeks before, thankfully, I've got friends that are honest with me. They were like, dude, you got to do something. My mom was on it right away. She likes it high and tight, so she kept saying cut it. But
moms always are.
My wife is kind of in the fashion, beauty. She loves that kind of stuff, and she blogs about it. So I've got a good at-home consultant, and I finally got the humility to ask her. I was like, hon, I've got a situation going on. How do you deal with long hair? And so she was like, you can't wash it every day. You can't. So she just gave me all the things. And I've started doing that. And now it's kind of fun. I'm kind of just going to.
You've got this like a river runs through it thing going on, you know, from that movie. Okay. And then, you know, when you're out with the horses or something, that's kind of what I just thought of, was a river runs through it for some reason, that movie.
I used to have reasons why I felt like I couldn't, because I'd be like, you know, I'm going to go, because I am fortunate to get to do some media opportunities around our, you know, the Dr. Bills and other things. And I'm thinking, oh, I can't go on there with scruff and long hair. But I'm like, who says I can't?
You can.
So just I'm going
be
for
more,
it.
Just be more you, Miles.
Yeah.
I got to say, though, the pomade era was a real high point, Miles. I mean, it was, look and notice good hair. And I got to say,
I'm enjoying this,
but it's definitely a different vibe.
Well, and you know what? I think
I'm high and tight.
I think I'm in the final years of I'm getting, it's starting to go a little gray. I won't have it forever. And I used to, when somebody would say, you got good hair, I'd try to blow it off and be the cool guy. And it's like, oh, I don't care. And the truth, I was like, I'm grateful that good hair. So
really proud of my mane.
I'm embracing it now.
I'll tell you what else is coming out with your long hair, though. And it may be because I'm watching the TV show, but I just got the box set of the 80s primetime soap opera Hotel, starring James Brolin. Have you ever been told you remind people of James Brolin?
A time or two.
Okay, because I'm really getting strong James Brolin vibes.
I'll take that as a big compliment. He's a handsome dude.
Well, yeah. But he had a beard on the show. Yeah, and of course, I seriously, if we're talking about addictions, I think that's a healthy one that I just like, I'm going to watch an episode of Hotel from 1984 that has nothing to do with anything.
That's hilarious, because as you mentioned James Brolin, it made me think of that episode of Friends where Phoebe was trying to like play off. Remember at Monica and Chandler's wedding where they find out that Rachel's pregnant, but they don't know it yet, and Phoebe's like, James Brolin's the father, like, because they're playing off as Phoebe's pregnant, even though it's Rachel. And so you say James Brolin, and I'm like, where have I heard James Brolin lately? But it's because I always have Friends going on in the background is like my mindless thing.
Oh my gosh.
To like check out. So if you need to talk about James Brolin more, you just go watch that episode of Friends with Phoebe.
Yeah.
Are we really, really derailed over here? We did.
I love a good tangent, though.
Yeah, I do love a good tangent. Miles, thank you so much, friend, for being here.
And I don't feel like we talked about the Unspoken Podcast. I feel like we could do another episode on how do you host a podcast? But I've really been enjoying listening
Season two is right around the corner. And man, we've got some amazing interviews. We've got them all done except for one, I think. And Ruthie, as you shared, you've known her. She's just been such a a great co-host, mm-hmm. and we just had so much fun. Aren't these conversations so fun?
I mean,
when
we
I saw
love
you two start this one, knowing both of you, I thought, because y'all kind of got a similar vibe to you.
Which we talked about it around that time, because I think you guys were thinking about starting yours, or were in the process, which I think we still need to have like that powwow offline of like best practices and like things you're learning and things we're learning. But
we should do like a joint podcast off the road.
Oh my gosh. No, seriously, I've learned things from y'all's website and social media stuff, you know, and you know, I've totally stolen from y'all. So thanks.
Oh, thank you.
We just talked just a little, cause we didn't dive into it, just for people listening at home, like give us just what's the heart behind it? The premise behind it, just for anyone listening.
Well, thank you for
cause
asking.
You need to listen.
Thank you. It came out of a theory that I've got good friends, like Donald Miller, who's brilliant as a storyteller, but he's also got this company that helps people clarify their brands mm-hmm. called Story Brand. And he was after me because he believed in our product. He said, but it's not clear on what you do and you don't tell the best story. So we've constantly been trying to drill down as part of my homework to drilling down into what we do. It was part of an interview. Somebody said, you know, if you could really narrow down, with the thousands of people that you get the opportunity to help, what is it that you actually do? And I thought, you know, we just help people say the unsaid. And so sometimes that's going backwards, sometimes it's current, sometimes it's going forward, but we help people speak their truth. And so that's where Unspoken came from. I did a TED talk on it that it's a long story, but it'll be out soon. But and I'm working on a book, and then had the idea of what if we could have conversations, because it's Unspoken is the name of it. The subtitle is Why Saying the Unsaid is One of the Hardest and Most Important Things We'll Ever Do. And it was just to have conversations like these and not make them. I think people would predict that I was doing a therapy podcast, and it's not. It just is humanizing deep moments and trying to give people an opportunity. Sometimes I'll bring that knowledge in if it's helpful, but more it's just exactly what you guys are inviting, for people to be real, speak their truth.
And have great conversations. I mean, that's why we started this. So basically we can talk about whatever we want, including Aquanet, Aquanet and pomade over here.
And the Judds.
Lord, and the Judds, always the Judds.
Eternally.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Miles.
And I know I've said this, but I'm just really grateful for Onsite, and just I think I feel more fully me than I've felt in AM in a really long time. So I'm just really grateful, and I'm grateful for you and Lindsay's in here too, just for the work you guys do and the work that is done at Onsite, and just all the incredible counselors and therapists out there that have such a gift. They really have such a gift. The good ones are really special. So.
Well, this has really been a treat. It's been an honor to be with both of you, and thanks for having me.
Well, of course, we have to end with hair care and pomade because it's so important.
Well, you know, I mean, we're working a lot on the inner self, but the outer self, I'm also fascinated with as well. So thanks for thanks for letting us come. We came up for air, and it's great.
I know. Thanks for your insight, Miles. I mean, if you see his hair, it's looking really great now.
Spectacular.
And I do think it would be really fun for us to have Ruthie in here as well. The four of us on a joint podcast would be great.
I feel that. Yeah, Ruthie's a really great friend, and she's been there for me through some really tough times. I really feel a connection with her. So it would be good. I think it'd be deep.
It would be deep. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. And if there was something that really resonated with you in this episode, you know, feel free to reach out to us confidentially, and messaging on social media will help you to try and get resources that you need. And we'll also include some of those resources that Miles mentioned in the show notes and on our website at allourfavoritepeople.com as well. So you can find us on social media at All Our Favorite People. You can find me at Ashley Eicher. You can find Hunter at Nashville HK. Thank you guys so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.